Welcome to episode 721 with my guest, Ethan Sapienza. Very excited for you guys to hear our conversation in depth about dialectical behavior therapy. I think it's such an important modality, and it can help so many people. What do I want to share with you? Are you feeling sad? I'm not going to get into politics. I want this podcast to be inclusive, although sometimes I do mention it. But, you know, the only times that when it's affecting my mental health, and God, I've got to be honest, it is affecting my mental health. But I don't know. I feel like I've been talking about stuff outside. I don't know. I'm confused. I think a lot of people are feeling confused right now. A lot of people are very excited. But it's so hard to accept the things that we can't control. You know, it's the serenity prayer. And I try to live that prayer, but it is so hard. When there's just fear, and anger. Anyway. Whew. Got some emails last week and a couple of weeks before, people upset at me caring about the deaths, the ongoing deaths of civilians. And upset about the deaths of civilians a year ago. But I don't know. If you want to know more about that subject, my best suggestion is to listen to Gabor Mate. I like how I said I wasn't going to talk about politics, and now I'm talking about politics. But to me, it's a humanitarian issue. And Dr. Gabor Mate, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name, is a preeminent, globally renowned and respected human rights, mental health, physical health, spiritual health. He's a compassionate, wise man. He's a survivor of the Holocaust, and he speaks very eloquently about what the myths are around what's happening in the Middle East. And it was so hard for me to not engage with people who said, I'm no longer supporting you because of your views. And it stirs up anger in me, but I can't control where they get their news sources, what their opinion is. Everybody, myself included, we filter reality through our lived experience and our feelings. But all I can do is try to speak my truth around what I see as awful. If I were to talk about all the things that I think are awful, I feel like I could do an entire episode on it. But for me to be mentally healthy, I have to see what is right in the world, not ignore what's wrong in the world, but to accept the things, and that doesn't mean I can't work to fight against them, but to not get angry at the things I can't control, because it's such a waste of energy, and it then taints the other parts of our lives. You know, I don't know who said it, but somebody said, be the change that you want to see in the world. And so I want to see people take more naps and then relapse and start playing video games again because they're sad. That's the change that I'm embodying. Yeah. Sweet, sweet civilization called to me last week, and I think I've played it five nights of the last week, and it's just it's so interesting how things that are, you know, kind of compulsive or addictive for us, we can get away from them for a while and feel like, oh, I'm out of the woods with this thing. It doesn't have a grip on me anymore. And then we go through something where we feel emotions we don't want to feel. And then the image of that pops into our head. Oh, playing Civilization. Oh, and I could just feel the dopamine rush before I even booted it up. And I had deleted it from my computer because I was like, I don't need this anymore. Repurchased it, downloaded it again. It was almost like I was watching myself repurchase it. Like, you know, this isn't a healthy tool. But instead of shaming myself for it, like I talk on the podcast a lot, I just said to myself, hey, this isn't the ideal choice to deal with your feelings, but it is what it is. Don't hate on yourself for doing it. But don't keep it a secret. Talk about it. So I've been, and to some of you, you may be thinking, what do you keep it a secret that you're playing video games? Why would you be ashamed of that? But I mean, shame, fuck. I could do a whole episode on shame. Anyway, let's read a couple of surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this is filled out by Dookie Hauser, MD. And about his depression, he writes, seasonal depression. As the leaves turn and fall, so does my mood. That's a good one. About his anxiety, things are going well for me right now, which means I must have a terminal disease or the world is ending. About his compulsive eating. To quote Bill on King of the Hill, if you're feeling full, at least you're feeling something. Those are good. Those are good. Thank you for those. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a non-binary person who calls themselves Lemon Rain. And they write, have you had an occupational therapist as a guest? As someone who is studying to become one, I think you could have a very interesting discussion with someone whose work focuses on people struggling with mental health issues and or addiction, etc. And I wasn't really sure what an occupational therapist was, and so I looked it up, and the definition that I found says occupational therapy is a healthcare profession that helps people develop, recover, or maintain skills for daily living and working. Occupational therapists use a variety of techniques to help people evaluate, review medical history, interview clients, and observe them perform tasks. Develop treatment plans, create specific activities to help clients work towards their goals. Demonstrate exercises. Teach exercises to help relieve pain. Evaluate the environment. Identify accessibility improvements in a client's home, school, or workplace. Educate family. Teach family members how to accommodate and care for the client. Recommend equipment. Suggest mobility aids, eating aids, and other special equipment. And assess progress. Record clients' activities and progress for evaluations, billing, and other purposes. That's very helpful. And that is a good idea, because that stuff does, it's like our mental health issues and oftentimes our physical health issues, they don't come at us out of a vacuum, and things that are seemingly unrelated, sometimes we can have kind of a light bulb moment or have somebody have a light bulb moment for us, which leads me to the next part of her survey. She writes, it might be interesting, I'm sorry, they write, might be interesting to have a survey for light bulb moments when you realize something fundamental about your life. And I had one previously, and for some reason the link to it was no longer on the website under the list of surveys you can take. And so we've added it, and we've retitled it Light Bulb Moments. So I shot my web guy an email, and hopefully he will be posting that there, because that those are really, from people's experiences, that is one of my favorite things to hear, is have an epiphany, a light bulb moment, whatever you want to call it, a moment of growth. Include any of those if you're going to fill that survey out. And if I didn't mention it, our website is metalpod.com. This is from the Shame and Secrets survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Trying to Heal. She identifies as straight. She's in her 30s, says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. I had a relationship with a man who was 31 years older than me that started when I was 17 until he passed when I was 25. It was never strange to me, but now that I'm older, I realize that was not okay. I had a great life with him. I really did. But looking back, I know that it shouldn't have happened. She's been emotionally abused. Let's just state the obvious, daddy issues, which explains why I did what I did. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yeah, but she doesn't elaborate. Darkest thoughts. I just feel gross now. Again, I don't regret the relationship because we really did have a good life together. But if I had a better relationship with my dad, I don't believe that would have happened. Darkest secrets. I hate what I did, the choices that I made. Now that I'm older and have a new outlook, I feel unclean and just weird and gross. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you? I really don't have any now. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I just want to apologize to anyone I've hurt with the dumb choices I made. It comes down to just wanting to feel loved and wanted. I would have let anything happen in order to feel special. Boy, doesn't that just hit the nail on the head? That's usually what we're looking for, is just we want to feel loved and safe. Or just don't want to feel what it is that we're feeling. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace. Have you shared these things with others? Yes, and most people say they understand and that I'm not scum. But I don't know if they are telling the truth. Why would somebody say that you're scum? I don't understand why you think that what you did is scummy on your part. Only people I'm close with know my whole story. Other than that, I want to shut that part of my life completely out with other people. How do you feel after writing these things down? Okay, I guess. I mean, it doesn't make me feel better or worse, really. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experience? Everyone has a past they aren't proud of. Everyone makes choices that they wish they could change. I think the thing that has helped me is that I know and understand why I made the choices I made. I was young and impressionable. I wanted an escape from my father, who was there physically but not emotionally. I did what I thought I needed to do to help give me a better life, and it did. That doesn't make it right, but I wouldn't have had the life I had without the man I was in the relationship for 8 years with. I loved him, but I loved the life he gave me. Once you understand why you acted and did the things you did, it's kind of easier to forgive yourself. Thank you for that. Sending you a hug. And you were looking for love. I hope you can feel some of that towards yourself, but easier said than done. We're going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors. This episode is sponsored by 23andMe. We talk a lot about health, mental health, being proactive, taking an interest in self-care. And I'm really fascinated by the reports that I'm getting. It is extensive, the number of things that they test for. 23andMe is not used to diagnose any kind of medical condition. What they can tell you is whether or not you have the genetic variants that predispose you towards certain things. You can also get a ton of ancestry information. My genes come from Britain and Ireland, which makes sense because I oppress myself. So, advocate for your health today. Go to 23andme.com/mental for your limited time offer. That's 23andme.com/mental. And as always, we put the links to our advertisers in the show notes for the episode. This episode is sponsored by Orgain Organic Protein Powder. One of the things I love is when there's a product that I already use and love, and they advertise on the podcast. Let me tell you about Orgain. 21 grams of complete protein with all 9 essential amino acids. They taste great. In fact, I just had a shake About a half hour ago, I like making a batch, and then I put it in my little shaker bottles, and I have them to drink over the next couple of days. So remember, there are no quick fixes when it comes to your health. If you want more protein, give Orgain Organic Plant Protein Powder a try. Head to Orgain.com/Mental30 and use the code Mental30 for 30% off your order. It's the best offer you'll find, but you have to use my code Mental30 for 30% off. One last time, for 30% off, head to Orgain.com/Mental30 and use the code Mental30. The links to all this stuff and the reminder of the codes are in the show notes, as always. And then finally, this is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Lane, and she struggles with rapid cycling, bipolar, intrusive thoughts, and ADHD. And snapshots from those, she writes, rapid cycling bipolar, switching states of being, like switching pictures on a viewfinder, click, click, click. About intrusive thoughts, I'm standing on a bridge over an evil swamp, crawling with crocodiles, arachnids, and other nameless creatures. And if I don't look down, the swamp won't swallow me. And then again and again, I look down. That's such a good one. And about her ADHD, in a Zoom work meeting, phone propped up against the computer screen so it looks like I'm listening, while I watch muted Dr. Pimple Popper videos or Google, what does it mean that I have clubbed thumbs?
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out.
All my alters have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lies.
A kind pimp.
Yes.
The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, you first. And I said, I might be gay. I was with a girl. And I said, and what do you have to tell me? She said, I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session.
I'm here with Ethan Sapienza. You're a licensed clinical social worker, you do DBT, you do EMDR, a bit of OCD with exposure therapy.
Yes.
Or maybe it's more than a bit of...
Yeah. It's a lot of exposure therapy.
Okay.
I mean, I'll get a little bit into how I like to work, but I would say exposure really kind of informs a lot of the stuff that I like to do with people, and I think what can often be really helpful for a lot of the difficulties that people, that they experience that bring them to therapy, basically. So, you tell me where you want me to kind of start with what you want me to talk about.
Well, I'd like to start with your personal story. I'm just going to move your mic up a tiny bit.
Sure.
The cliche, doctor, heal thyself. What's your fucked up, Ethan?
I mean, this is going to be really surprising to hear, but I think some of it might have to do a little bit with my family. I would say my parents, they are very loving, very supportive. I don't know if they have the best marriage, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There was just like a lot of conflict growing up, and I've always kind of been, sometimes my mom dings me for being too diplomatic. She would say, I don't know. I would like to say now I'm doing DBT. I'm very dialectical, is the term I would use. But, I just often was like sort of the one who would try to find some peace in my family, try to like fix a lot of, the whatever issues were going on. Even I have an older brother who he and I are very close, but he'll have conflict with my parents. It's still like, it can be a little bit of an ongoing thing sometimes, but.
So you were the peacemaker.
Yes. I was very much so the peacemaker. And I initially didn't think I necessarily wanted to do therapy in my life. And in fact, I was interested originally in film criticism. I loved Roger Ebert growing up.
The best. I'm from Chicago.
Oh, so, yeah, true. There you go. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you're more Ebert than Siskel?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. Yes. I mean, I would agree. I like him.
Siskel could get a little nasty.
He could. Yes. Yes. He could. He could. And a little erudite. Yeah. I loved
it. A little cranky.
Ebert. Yes. Very much so. Very much so. I mean, Ebert too, but I miss him.
excuse me.
You're all good. Are you okay?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So anyway, I was pursuing it originally, for a number of reasons, realized it wasn't really kind of the right fit for me. I was in therapy myself at the time. I was just going through a number of different kind of life stressors, you could say. And I was like, you know, I've always really thought therapy was very interesting and cool. I've always kind of admired it. And I decided to kind of give it a shot. I talked about it a bunch with my own therapist who, in talking about the different routes to become a clinician or a psychotherapist or whatever term you kind of want to use, what he talked a bit about was essentially how, like, so much of it, especially in today's day and age, it kind of becomes letters after your last name, depending on kind of the degree you get, essentially, whether you're a PhD, I'm an LCSW, or there's LMFTs, or there's LPCCs, there's all these LMHCs, there's all these different acronyms now. But it like kind of boils down to a little bit of just, they're letters after your name. Even when I talk to people now who are like interested in going to grad school, they'll kind of ask me, should I do this? Should I do that? And frankly, if you want to just do therapy, like if that's solely your interest, then it makes the most sense to do kind of one of these master's programs, like a social work program or, you know, a master's in psychology in California to become an MFT. Just because, like, I'll ask people this, it's like with your own therapist, like, have you asked them about where they went to school? Like, no, you end up caring way more about the therapist itself and your relationship and what you think of this person and if you feel, you know, seen and heard by them and they're helping. Mm-hmm. It's all that stuff. But he helped me through a lot of that. I'm parroting from him. And so I ultimately decided to go to social work school, just being, I was in New York at the time. And MFT is just sort of not nearly as common on like the East Coast as compared to in California. It was actually something at the time I wasn't like even really aware of. And I decided to go to Columbia for social work school. And I kind of just by happenstance, that's how I found out about DBT. Because Columbia Social Work School, at least the last time I checked, I hope this is still correct, they're the only social work school in the country that has like a DBT program that...
Wow.
Yeah. While you're in school, you can apply and you can spend a whole year basically learning DBT. And I am very... I'm specifically mentioning this all by name because I'm very indebted to the program. So I want to kind of like promote them, essentially. I'm not trying to like... I don't know. That is like my whole intention of being like, that's why I'm naming the school I went to and all that stuff, because I heard about it. I heard great things about it. I didn't know a lot about DBT, and I got in and I, you know, just was fortunate enough to learn from like really brilliant, amazing, wonderful people. And it has like really informed how I've been able to practice as a therapist and honestly how I approach a lot of life now, because so much of DBT, which I know you've had folks on before, to talk about DBT, so you tell me how much you want me to get into the specifics of it.
I'd love to get into as much as you would like to share, because we touch on it here or there, but we rarely do a really deep dive on it. And for those who aren't familiar with it, it's dialectical behavior therapy, and it was invented by Marsha Linehan, who herself has... a borderline personality disorder.
Yes.
Or as it's called sometimes, emotional dysregulation disorder.
Right.
Before we talk about DBT, talk about the elements of borderline personality disorder and how DBT addresses that. DBT is used to the listener for things outside of borderline personality disorder. It's a great de-escalator. Law enforcement people are sometimes taught it to help de-escalate, but back to you.
Yeah, no, of course. So, I think to your point, right, it has a lot of applications because it's very skills-based. It's about learning ways essentially to cope, to put it very simplistically. So, I mean, hey, we all need to cope, right, every single day.
Everybody could use DBT.
Sure, yes, everybody. And I think... Yeah, there are a lot of skills that are just very applicable and very helpful. And there are like increasingly in a lot of schools now, you'll see with like kids being taught some more sort of specific coping skills and a lot of them more, you know, kind of like mindfulness.
So important.
Which it is.
So important. Yeah. So much more important than algebra. And
yes. Yes.
All the other bullshit that we forget the minute we graduate.
Yeah, geometry is, I never use it ever in my life. I spend a lot of time thinking about triangles in my younger life.
Menage a trois. That's the only thing you need to know triangle for.
Yes, there you go. And that's actually to your point. That's something I try to say to a lot of clients, because I will work with people who they have a lot of shame in dealing with like how emotionally dysregulated they can get. And I'm like, no one taught you this. Like if you were never taught these things, like how are you ever expected to understand them, deal with them, all that kind of stuff? It's kind of like being thrown in a car and being told to drive, right? You're going to get into a car accident is what is going to happen.
Right.
And
borderline personality is not a personal shortcoming.
No, no.
It's a disorder that needs tools, just like any other thing, like OCD, like depression.
Definitely, yes. So to get back to your question about that, I'm going to help explain a little bit about what BPD is. I'm going to draw from what we teach everybody who does comprehensive DBT, which is sort of the formal name for when you do the whole thing by the book. It's a thing called the biosocial theory, which it helps us to explain why for some people they struggle with more emotion dysregulation than others, or pervasive emotion dysregulation, right? You mentioned emotion dysregulation disorder before. So, I mean, all of us...
Is there a spectrum, a continuum of the intensity of DBT? Borderline personality disorder?
I mean, sure. Yeah, it's not in something that you necessarily diagnose. Like if you open up the DSM, it's not like, you know, mild, moderate, severe. Yet, I mean, increasingly, I think a lot of the ways people approach... diagnosing, they're trying to sort of see it as more of like a spectrum, right? It's not a light switch. It's not on or off. You have depression or you don't, right? You have anxiety or you don't. It's like there's a gradient to these things. You have OCD or you don't. And I would say the same is true for something like BPD. All of us, like myself, you, everybody listening, gets dysregulated just because our emotions can get quite intense. We can get upset. This is where we shut down. We can want to stay in bed. We get very upset. We raise our voice. We slam things. We, you know, can turn to some maladaptive coping mechanisms like substances, or often is the case with BPD, things like self-harm or suicide. And the question just becomes, okay, for some folks, the folks who have BPD, as well as some who don't necessarily meet full criteria, yet still present in similar ways, you could say, why is that the case? And so there's the two parts to it. There's the bio and the social of this biosocial theory. The bio refers to how we're born, right? The way
genetics.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just who we are, right? I didn't choose my hair or my eye colors in the same way that the way we have this theory is there are aspects of our emotions that we did not choose. And there are sort of three of them that we often see are the case for folks coming into DBT. One is there's a higher sensitivity to emotions, which I know can be a bit of like a sensitive term for some folks, because oftentimes people will say you're so sensitive in this very pejorative and judgmental way, which I really try to dispel. Like emotions, so much of it are they're like the color of life is kind of what I like to say to people, because it's truly like, you know, when you listen to music, you know, you do it because of oftentimes the things it makes you feel. Imagine feeling nothing as you listen to music. That wouldn't be so great. So by being more sensitive, it's just that we're feeling these things more intensely. And that can be really amazing. It can also be very punishing, obviously, because when we're sad, we're frustrated, we feel defeated.
Abandonment is a big one.
Oh, absolutely. Abandonment. Yes. Feeling like people are leaving us. That's oftentimes in the DSM, which is not so much a perfect book yet. It's what our industry goes off of. That is sort of often one of the criteria we look for, is like people's sort of fear of abandonment, whether it's real or perceived. But so having that higher sensitivity is one. Then there's a higher reactivity to emotions. So just when like things kind of come up, just how strongly people naturally respond to them on an emotional level. The image we like to give people is it's sort of like, imagine you're sitting in the room with someone who has third degree burns on their skin, and like a little gust of wind comes, right? For you, you may not notice that. The person next to you is going to go, ow, they're going to like, you know, they're going to exclaim in pain, right? And that's what a lot of times, especially folks with, you know, BPD, or especially have not done DBT, that it's what life can really sort of feel like.
I've heard people with it use that term, that it feels the emotions, they feel like there's a fire inside them.
Oh my goodness. I mean, listen, emotions are intense, right? They can, I mean, even myself, I'm a fairly sensitive person, I think. And sometimes I'm not so happy about that, because they can be incredibly painful. I think a lot of times we like to minimize how painful emotions can be. And so oftentimes I like to ask clients, like, what would you rather feel, physical pain or emotional pain? And I don't know, do you have an answer to that? If you have a preference between one of the two?
I think physical pain.
Right, which is, that's oftentimes, it's
it would depend on the pain in the body part.
For sure. Yes. Right. It's not by no means is there sort of a perfect answer. Neither are preferable. And I think that a lot of people answer that, and it speaks to how much we minimize how painful our emotions can be. The third piece of the bio, I'll try to run through that, is, you know, sort of a slower return to baseline, which is just sort of like how long it takes for our emotions to come down. So all of that sort of together is someone who's like pretty sensitive. We could just kind of say nothing wrong with that. Yet where the sort of the pain part comes in is the social piece, and what we sort of see in someone's social environment oftentimes is that they have experienced a lot of invalidation, which to be invalidated is just means that someone's not basically sort of seeing your experience or hearing your experience. This comes in many different forms. Being ignored is pretty invalidating.
Which is a form of abandonment.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Totally. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, even abandonment in and of itself is a fairly, can be quite an invalidating experience, feeling like we're trying to talk to someone, seek help, have people look after us, and then for them to just sort of up and leave. I mean, is incredibly, it makes us feel like we've done something wrong. There are not people understanding us. It's a really miserable experience.
And the message is the same to somebody who's being overtly abused, because the message is the same, which is you don't matter, your needs don't matter, and it doesn't really matter what envelope that arrives in.
Yes.
It's the message.
Very much so, yes.
You know, whether it's a parent that's not interested in you.
Yes, and actually to talk about abuse, that's something that Marcia Linehan talks about in the manual for DBT, where you will find a lot of, unfortunately, folks with BPD have a history of some kind of physical or sexual abuse. It's not everybody, yet there is a pretty high percentage of people. And those are incredibly invalidating experiences, because oftentimes what is happening after them, these experiences in which you're feeling defiled and something is disgusting, it's horrible, you're being told afterwards either, don't tell people about this, or it's fine, or I did this to you because you're special, or I believe in you, or something like that. And it's a very confusing, very invalidating experience. And what this leads to is a couple of kind of different things for people. Why invalidation is sort of seen as like kind of the key thing is because, one, we start to kind of say these things to ourselves, which just does not work. Okay. It makes your emotions feel worse. I tell this to people. I'm like, listen, if invalidating yourself worked, I would tell you to do it. Just plain and simple. It's not some like be kind to yourself sort of sentiment.
No, bury it and earn a lot of money. That'll fix you.
Right. Exactly. Yes. And fortunately, we can see, you know, some folks might do that. But we're learning a pretty ineffective way to cope with our emotions by trying to invalidate ourselves. We're also, you know, trying to suppress our emotions, as you talked about burying it. We're told like, don't bring this up. Don't, you know, you're making this up. Don't talk about this, whatever. Burying our emotions also doesn't work. So these are things that actually make us feel worse. We're trying to deal with already being emotionally sensitive, and then we're feeling worse and worse. And then lastly, you know, one of the reasons oftentimes folks with BPD are called manipulative has to do with sort of this last piece, in which a lot of times, I mean, if we're trying for people to see us, to not leave us, to not abandon us, to not, you know, just for us to be heard, we're going to learn new ways of communicating. If I'm basically saying, ow, you know, I'm in pain, and everyone ignores me or says, I don't care, right? So maybe I might start getting extremely depressed to the point that I don't get out of bed. Or maybe I'm telling people that I'm going to kill myself. Or maybe I cut myself and I show people, you know, the wounds, which I realize, I'm sorry, I guess I should have set a content warning about this stuff, because I know Katie.
It's okay. This entire show is a gigantic
sure,
trigger.
Sure. So. That's a fair point. And what happens a lot of times is we'll engage in these behaviors, and then all of a sudden our environment goes, oh my God, what's wrong? Not even necessarily in a warm way. It doesn't have to be in a warm way. Yet what we learn sort of in you know, almost like unconsciously, we could say, without, we don't even have to be aware of this, is, oh, I have to basically, you know, ramp it up to 11. I have to do these, you know, whatever, this shit basically to get people to see what I'm going through. And it's this kind of back and forth play between us and the people around us, in which we keep kind of engaging these behaviors. We're suppressing ourselves. Our environment's getting upset. They say they don't want to deal with us. And then we're escalating things. And then they're like, oh my God, what's wrong? And it's this sort of this push and pull that leads to folks developing BPD, which is often, right, this sort of sense of oftentimes there's suicide and self-harm, yet not always. There's a fear of abandonment. There's just oftentimes like an explosion, it will seem, of emotions. A lot of times people will present with anger. There's a lot of times dissociative features too, where dissociation is essentially like feeling like we're shutting down, feeling outside of ourselves. It's what we see in DBT, or the way we think of it is it's kind of a way of also coping with our emotions, in which we're just, our body's kind of like powering down because what we're feeling is just so painful. We're like, we don't want to experience this anymore, which, though dissociation in and of itself is a very, very upsetting and unsettling thing for people to experience and deal with chronically. It's unfortunately, it's just a lot of people are just really struggling on how to best understand their emotions, regulate themselves. They just never really got a shot to be able to do that. And so that's so much of what we do in DBT is we try to understand, okay, hey, what are you doing and why? Right? We try to take this really understanding approach to our behaviors. Because behaviors can both be functional in that I get suicidal because it helps me calm down, and at the same time, not really something we want to engage in, right? Because obviously suicide is not ever an answer to a problem, right? We say it's a very long-term solution to a short-term problem. It's also, there's no guarantee it's going to do any of the stuff you want it to do. I don't know what happens when we die. I do know that, you know, using some of our DBT skills does help us calm down. So maybe we should do that instead. Yeah, I mean, does that kind of address the things you were?
It does.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Of course.
So give me kind of a typical example of you walking somebody through, somebody with BPD, mm-hmm. walking them through DBT.
Okay, sure. So the way I like to do that is I actually like to break down even each letter of the acronym, why it's there for, what are all the components, all that stuff. So the D stands for dialectical, which is a word that if you don't know what that means, no judgment whatsoever. I didn't know what it meant until I
still
I did
don't
DBT.
Know what it means.
So it's when there are two things that are true at the same time and are in opposition of one another. And so a very simple way of identifying a dialectic is with the word but, B-U-T. Because what is that word doing in a sentence is when there's two opposing things. And we don't really like the word but in DBT because what that does is it's sort of saying it's one or the other. Like, I'm tired, but I have to get out of bed. So we're ignoring the fact that we're tired. And to make it more of a dialectic, we say and. So I'm tired and I want to get out of bed. And the reason dialectics are important, there's a couple of them. One is, I kind of mentioned it before, so much of the approach we're doing with folks is, you know, we're trying to understand our behaviors and can say that we don't like them, right? So it can be both rather than shaming and judging ourselves. Like, why the fuck do I keep doing this? Why do I keep drinking? Why do I keep doing, what's wrong with me, right? That's not an approach that's going to get us anywhere, unfortunately. The other is, I mean, it just provides a lot more mental flexibility. Honestly, I try to encourage lots of people to be dialectical rather than this sort of like, I have to do this or this, this sort of black and white thinking we often talk about with folks who are like depressed or anxious, right? It can be both of these things. Oftentimes we can find something in the middle. Also, it helps to rectify a lot of difficult stuff. Like, you know, so many people who come into DBT are suicidal. And frankly, that is a dialectic in and of itself because they want to live and they want to die, right? Those are both things that they're experiencing at the same time, because if they just wanted to live, they wouldn't be suicidal. And if they just wanted to die, they wouldn't be there, right? So it helps us to really just try to understand, okay, what's going on sort of both sides of whatever may be conflicting within a person or within a relationship, because oftentimes that's dialectical too. I'm upset, this other person's upset, so on and so forth. So dialectics are just helpful in general. I would say they're also, it's so much of our treatment is about balancing acceptance and change. We first have to accept things in order to change them. You know, anybody who's sober knows you first have to accept that you may have an issue as it comes to using substances in order to then be able to change that, right? So that's another thing. So that's dialectics. Then behaviors, that's what we focus on in treatment. So when clients are coming in for sessions, we're talking about their behaviors basically every single session. Typically, it's if someone is suicidal or self-harming or engaging in, we call them life-threatening behaviors. That's what we focus on first, because if someone's dead, well, therapy is not going to work, just because I don't know any therapies that work for dead people, essentially.
Even with a really good therapist?
Unfortunately, yeah, even with a really good one. No one's cracked it just yet. I'm curious to hear if somebody does figure that one out. I feel like that would change quite a lot of things in life, even outside of therapy. But
enter
so,
Jesus the therapist.
Sure. I mean, that would be quite something. so we focus on behaviors. We're trying to just understand why you're doing these things, as well as what skills come into play too. So those are the behaviors we're teaching people. And there are four modules or categories of skills we teach people. There's mindfulness, which is how to be present, essentially, and aware of ourselves. There's emotion regulation, skills to understand and then try to regulate our emotions, help to sort of change them or as best as we can as they're coming up. Skills for interpersonal effectiveness, so just how to be as our best selves in relationships, essentially. And then distress tolerance, so skills to help us tolerate the times when we're really distressed and upset and feeling like in a crisis without making things worse, right? Because that's so often when we engage in all the stuff that we don't like. So that's the B, that's the behavior. And then the therapy part, I mentioned before that word comprehensive. So if folks are ever looking for DBT online, you can see it used in a lot of different terms. But what Marshall Linehan made, what the book is kind of about is what's called comprehensive DBT. And there's four parts to the therapy. So there's individual sessions where, like I said, with your therapist, you're working on your behaviors, all that stuff. There's a lot to it, but for the sake of time, I won't get into it. Then there's a skills group. That's the second part of the treatment. And in the skills group, it's more like a class. You're just going once a week and you're just being taught all of the skills of DBT, all those four modules. Typically takes about 6 months. Sometimes people stay for a year. Just you do it twice. It just can be helpful.
What are some of the skills?
Yeah, sure. So I'll sort of reference one of the more famous ones. So it's called TIP. I don't know if you've ever heard of it by any chance. Okay. So it's a distress tolerance skill that we often teach people like first because it's just very effective as it comes to helping ourselves regulate when we're very upset. So it's an acronym. There's like a shit ton of acronyms in DBT. We love acronyms in DBT. And what it stands for is temperature, intense exercise, paced breathing, and paired muscle relaxation. So if you're really upset, what I teach people is this scale called the SUD scale, subjective units of distress. I didn't make this up. Lots of behavioral therapies use this. It's basically just how upset you are. When you're at a 7 to a 10, that's kind of like the red zone. It's when myself or you or anybody else, that's when we're not thinking straight, literally, and we just do all the stuff we don't love later. We're like, oh, man, why did I do that? So TIP is sort of one of like the hallmark skills that we want to use then. So temperature is when we do a thing called ice dives, which are you familiar with that by any chance?
I've heard of people holding ice cubes and maybe even throwing them in a bathtub.
Yes. So in a bathtub or typically what we teach people is you get a bowl of ice water. This is sort of like the most standard way of doing it. And you put it in front of you and then you put your face in it for 15 to 30 seconds. And you do that about, three, four times. Sometimes you can do more. And the reason for that is because it's basically tricking your brain into thinking that you just jumped into cold water. So we have this thing innately within us called the mammalian dive response. In which if you jump into cold water at any point in time, basically your body is sort of, kicking you into the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what helps us sort of like slow down a little bit more. It decreases, our heart rates and our, breathing rate and all this good stuff. Because basically if you're in cold water, you need to conserve energy in order to survive. So that's just like a thing that we can do without even thinking. And so by putting your face in cold water, you have convinced essentially your brain that you just jumped into cold water. And so you'll find people often dramatically are like, oh my God, wow, it feels like all of a sudden I've come down. Like I was in a crisis before and now, my distress has really dropped. You can also do this with ice packs in a certain way. You can do this by jumping into cold water. You can do a cold shower. You can put ice cubes on your face. But the point of it is holding your breath, submerging your face really in something cold, leaning forward to mimic that sort of dive are the keys of that. Then there's intense exercise, which I don't think I need to explain many of the details of, but it can often just help us really expend energy, help us, feel pretty tired afterwards, release a lot of the tension on our body. Also, exercise releases a lot of chemicals on our brain that just make us feel good. Then there's paced breathing, in which what we do is we breathe in for a shorter amount of time than we breathe out. Typically, I tell people 4 seconds in, 8 seconds out for about 2 minutes, if not longer, because breathing does calm us down. It's just breathing out is the thing that calms us down. And then lastly, there's paired muscle relaxation, which is basically squeezing your muscles and then releasing them and breathing out and telling yourself to relax essentially as you do it, because that helps to release a lot of the tension in your body. So that's one of the sort of examples of skills. So that's TIP. That's in a skills group. That takes typically about 60 minutes to run through the whole thing. So I'm doing my best here to try and make it make sense.
This is all so informative.
Okay. Yeah. I really appreciate you having me on because I really like the stuff that I feel very privileged to be able to do. And I just want people to know about it essentially. But so that's sort of one of the hallmark examples of a DBT skill. We also have a skill we talk about a lot called Wise Mind. That's from mindfulness. And that's a skill that's basically about just sort of getting in touch with your own you know, sort of internal sense of what's right and wrong for you, essentially, to put it very simplistically. It's, we call it sort of like the middle between emotion and reason. Emotions are great and also very painful and challenging. Reason is great. And also, if we're just, you know, reason-minded, as we say, we can be very cold and invalidating. That's also not very helpful. So we have to balance the two. What else here? There's a skill called check the facts, which is a lot of cognitive therapy, essentially. That's an emotion regulation skill. In which we're just trying to sort of, before reacting to a situation, let's say, you know, like someone's not responding to my text, let me check the facts and see, is there any hard evidence?
God, my therapist walked me through that
right.
So many times. Yeah. He would say, Paul, what are the facts on the ground?
And right.
I was like, well, they didn't send me a text to say that they hate me and
right.
They're done with our relationship.
Right, right. It's a hard thing to do, though. I mean, listen, I am a therapist. I talk about these things every day. I teach people this stuff every day, and I still have to use this stuff because there are times where I'm like, do they hate me now? Is that why they're not texting me back? I'm like, okay, Ethan, now you got to check the facts. So that's an emotion regulation skill. And then lastly, I guess I'll give a skill from each of the modules. There's the skill of Dear Man, which comes from interpersonal effectiveness, and that's another acronym too. That's basically just like a really effective way to ask for something or to make a request, essentially, where you kind of are describing the situation of whatever's going on, like, hey, you were late to dinner. Try not to be judgmental, like, about it. Just like literally say what happened. You were 20 minutes, you know, you were an hour late. That's probably a bit more of when that might come up. You were an hour late to dinner. Then we express how that made us feel. You know, that made me feel really upset and really hurt. Made me think that you don't care about me, because people can't read our minds. They don't know what we're thinking or feeling. So let's tell them. Then we assert our request. Next time, can you please just text me if you're running late? And then the R is the reinforce, in which we basically are telling the other person why it would be good for them to do that. Like, I'd really appreciate it. It would mean a lot to me, right? And then the man part is basically just how we can handle that conversation if it sort of continues. That's sort of an example of some of the skills that folks can learn in that skills group. Do you want me to go back to explaining the other two parts of?
Yes, please.
Okay, gotcha. So there's the individual part. There's the skills group. Those are some examples of the skills we learn, which it's the thing I think I said before, but I'll just say again, it's much more like a class. So if you've been to group therapy before, where it's about sort of forming, you know, cohesion obviously does matter, yet people don't really have to share much personal stuff if they don't want to. It's just about going and learning the skills. And then the third piece of the treatment is what's called phone coaching, in which the client can reach out to their therapist kind of typically 24/7 if they need help with using and applying their skills. It's not to like, oh my God, I need to tell you about this crazy conversation I just had. It's not that. It's more of like, I am fucking blazing mad. I want to do this, whatever. And I need help just calming down, right? That's an example of how to use phone coaching. And then lastly, the fourth piece is called the team meeting, which is what the therapists attend. Clients don't. And it is a standard part that you have to do in order to do comprehensive DBT, where everyone who is on a team together, who's doing DBT, they meet once a week. I actually had it this morning, where you basically just bring up what's going on, essentially, typically with your clients, and it's to help you be a better therapist, right? So I'm running into this wall. They're bringing up this thing. I'm trying this with them. They're saying it's not working. I just need help. And it's a way to, we call it sort of like therapy for the therapist, where we're basically like doing DBT on each other to help us like validate us, like, oh, that is so tough, right? And have you tried this? And maybe this idea to just help us move through some pretty challenging stuff.
Is one of the things that therapists who treat people with BPD, is it a challenge, and are there boundary testings?
Oh, sure.
Talk about those, because that's one of the things that I hear can be very frustrating for clinicians. Yeah. And some clinicians won't treat people with BPD. And I imagine that's one of the things that factor into them being unwilling.
Yes. Very much so. Unfortunately, I think
what can that look like? The boundary testing.
Sure. I mean, one thing I'll just say first. I think it's a totally valid question, and unfortunately, there's just a lot of I would say misunderstanding and a lot of judgment around BPD. So unfortunately, and there still are a lot of therapists you'll meet who will be like, "I won't work with that," or you know, borderlines. They'll sort of say are crazy and all this sort of stuff, which I think is pretty reprehensible. I mean, nobody is defined by their diagnosis. You know, someone's not a schizophrenic as well. Someone's not a cancer if they have cancer, right? It's right. Someone with BPD or someone
their
with
cancer risk.
Right. Yes, exactly. Right. But yeah, so it's something that definitely can come up, because a lot of times, you know, folks with BPD have a history of, like I was sort of saying, invalidation, which actually research is increasingly showing can in and of itself just be a traumatic thing to just kind of continuously live through. I think if anyone who's been invalidated on a number of occasions, this probably is not surprised to hear that. Yet it is literally something that people can develop, you know, post-traumatic stress over. And so they're just constantly like often scared people are going to leave them. You know, people have abandoned them before. People have been upset with them. They feel like they mess things up. And then suddenly when they meet people who things feel good with, they'll be like, oh my God, this is great. I want to really latch onto this relationship. So I mentioned phone coaching before. Sometimes you'll have clients who will really want to use phone coaching a lot. They'll be using it every single day. Maybe sometimes we would say is ineffectively. It's not, the point of it isn't necessarily to try and help learn their skills. It's because they want to feel connection. They want to share something. They're trying to form more of a relationship with their therapist. And this is another way in which dialectics are really helpful, where it's to approach that, to rectify that with somebody can be a challenging thing. It's one of the reasons why team can be helpful, because sometimes it can just be hard, right? We're trying not to hurt people who can be pretty emotionally sensitive while also trying not to, you know, reinforce behaviors that are not helpful for us as well as not for them. But where we approach it from a place of understanding, like, listen, I get it. If you like really working with me, or if you find coaching is really helpful, and at the same time, you know, this is not the point of it. I know this won't be helpful for you for X, Y, and Z reasons. And so we just are trying to problem solve it. Now, does that always go perfectly? No. Have I had clients say some things about me that they're not very happy with me about? No. There's a really amazing DBT therapist named Alan Fruzzetti, who I heard him once say that he got an email from a client that just said, I believe it said "fuck you" in all caps about him, you know, like hundreds of times over, just repeatedly. So those things can happen, and still, it's something that is you do want to be mindful of, where you have in DBT, we believe, a really person-to-person, genuine relationship with people, and at the same time, one that is focused on the therapist and the client. You know, us being in those roles, you know, I basically want to get myself out of a job with the people I'm really working with. You know, which can be a bummer when it comes to it, and also is the goal, right? I want people feeling like they don't need me. And it's something I will bring people to, essentially, right? If they, you know, if there's sadness around that, we can talk about it, we can validate it and process it and all that good stuff. And, you know, the real point of it, why we're coming to therapy, is because there's stuff that's going wrong in our life that we don't want to have continue in that sense. And in that way, we want our life to change. So, you know, we want to be mindful, definitely, of boundaries in the relationship, just so that it's working best for the client as well as for the therapist, so that you know, we can just do our job the way that we need to, basically.
Was there more to team than that? Sorry, I interrupted you with the thing about the boundary pushing.
No, you're good. I mean, there's like a structure to how you run team, sure. Yet, I mean, it's not. This is where there's just a lot of specifics to DBT that I could get into, and I think that for the, you know, the sake of time and just how much is digestible anyway, I don't know how much it's worth getting into. But yeah, the one other thing I'll say about team maybe is that the way it works is the therapists are bringing things to the agenda that they feel like they need help with. And they either are saying, basically, I need problem solving or I need validation. And the rest of the team, we stick to that, right? So if someone's like, I'm dealing with a client that's, it's just really frustrating me, you know, they're mm-hmm. constantly texting me and I'm trying to work on it with them, yet it's just like, it's really tiring me out and I just want validation. You're not really allowed to bring problem solving to that, because I think anyone has had the experience of where they're just feeling upset. They're feeling bummed out. They want people to hear them and say, like, I get it. That is painful. That stinks. You know, it's exhausting, all this sort of stuff. And then someone's like, well, have you tried this? And you're like, oh my God, no, that's not what I want to hear. Right. Nice. Please. In fact, that in and of itself can feel invalidating, because it's almost like you're saying, like, I'm doing something wrong.
It's right? So common in marriages, especially, you know, the classic one, as you know, is the male partner mm-hmm. is just like, well, try this yeah. or try that.
Yeah, why
and
not?
15 years into the marriage, they discover that their partner just wanted to be listened to.
Yeah, I mean, validation in and of itself can be something that's very regulating. It's one of the reasons why, excuse me, when I tell people to validate themselves or validate their partners, or parents validating their kids, it's just because it's something that helps people to feel understood. It's like, you know, it's sort of like social glue, right? We are social creatures. We like to be connected with people, and validation is like someone saying, I get it, right? It's like putting your arm around you, right? As compared to invalidation is like, I don't get it, you're wrong. And then it's like being shoved aside, right? And that has a real biological effect on us. You know, validation helps us to feel just calmer and more regulated, typically, right? As compared to invalidation, makes us feel worse. Mm-hmm. So yeah, to your point.
One of the things I think is so important, and I'll encounter this a lot with friends from my support group, is they'll be talking about somebody you know, they'll be like, I love my dad so much, and he's the most important person in the world to me. And I'll ask them, have you told him that?
Mm.
Or when was the last time you told him that?
Yeah.
I was like, it certainly would not hurt your relationship with them.
No.
To say that.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's, you know, one of the things that a lot of people, we all really can fuck up on is the thought that we can read people's minds almost, right? That I know this is why someone did this. And that works the other way around, where we can fuck up thinking people will just know what we're thinking or what we're feeling. And it's just, you know, it's just often such a good thing to just communicate what we're thinking or what we're feeling to people, even if it's something as simple as, well, obviously my dad knows that I love him, or he's so important to me, right? Well, it's, I mean, I hope he does. And the best way to guarantee that he does know it is to say it to him, right? Yeah. So it's definitely, it's something that I certainly encourage all the people I work with, whether I'm doing DBT with them or not, is to really to just, you know, let's play it safe. Let's just be really clear with the people in our lives, what we're thinking and how we're feeling, just because it usually works out a lot better than if we're like, no, I'm going to do this, and then they're going to, mm-hmm. they'll understand, right? It's, well, no guarantee for that one. No. Yeah.
So we talked about exposure therapy in the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah.
What does that look like, and what things do you use that for?
Yeah. So what I was originally trained in using it for was for OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, which has, briefly, I'll just say two parts to it, obsessions and compulsions. There you go. It's actually something I myself have, in which we obsess over something, we have fears about them, and then because of those fears, we engage in a compulsive behavior, something we feel the need to do in order to help us avoid the fears. And
are you comfortable talking about yours?
Sure. Yeah, okay. Totally. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times it comes up for me, I would say just, you know, my fear that I would say oftentimes a lot of people's fears boil down to something like kind of pretty general. We can say is like, well, you know, people think I'm an idiot or a bad person in some way. In the sense actually that this is a little bit arising, honestly, just talking with you, I'm going to be frank, in the sense of just like, I'm like, oh my God, people are going to be listening to me. What if I say something wrong? Oh, and then I say this, and then I say that, and people are going to think I'm an idiot.
I get that every time I do an episode.
Well,
every single time I look back and I was like, oh, I should cut that part out.
Yeah.
I look so selfish. I sound so stupid. I've forgotten something that I had mentioned before. I forgot that I already said that. I say this too much.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's, I hope I'm going to give you a little assurance, which is not something necessarily we do in exposure. And to say that it does not come across like that at all. You sound very, I would say,
ditto,
sure of yourself.
Buddy. Oh, ditto.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But so that is a lot of what I experienced. That actually has come up a lot in my work initially, especially when I was starting out, when I was in grad school, I was like terrified. Oh my God, I'm messing up constantly. And a compulsion, for example, what I would do is I would reread things. I would have to do research, or I could mentally reassure myself. So there's this misnomer with OCD. People call it pure O, which means like pure obsessions, which isn't actually like exactly correct. It's just, there are no behavioral compulsions visible compulsions, mm-hmm. like, you know, someone who's has the obsessions of their hands being dirty. Mm-hmm. What's the compulsion of that one?
Wash them.
Exactly.
100
right.
times.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So, and I'll get a little bit into, you know, how that develops in 100 times. What that can also look like is mentally, right? So telling myself it's going to be okay. You got this. It's going to be okay. Right. Or, I mean, sometimes people will recite certain things in their head. There's lots of different stuff. OCD can kind of get into this magical thinking, we call it, where it's like, we'll do seemingly absurdist things because of some great fears we have. I'm not going to step on any cracks because that's going to break my mother's back, for example, mm-hmm. right? How would that possibly happen? Yet it's the fear that I have. So the therapy I was originally trained in for that is called exposure and response prevention, which was made by a woman named Edna Foa. And she's like sort of one of the exposure masters, we could say. She's great. And that's all about basically exposing ourselves to our fears and then preventing ourselves from necessarily engaging in our responses, our typical ones, the compulsion. So someone who's scared of getting their hands dirty, let's go touch a lot of dirty stuff, and we're not going to wash our hands, and we're going to lean into all of our fears. Oh my God, I'm going to get sick, and I'm going to get other people sick, and oh, this and that, and this and that.
And it starts out small, correct?
We create what's called an exposure hierarchy, and essentially where we're looking at, okay, here's all the stuff that scares you, and let's rank it in terms of what's most difficult to least. And we do want to start with stuff that is still a bit challenging. It's just doable. So I mentioned that thing of the suds before, 0 to 10, how upset you are. We use that same scale. Usually want to start about a 4 or 5 for something with an exposure, because if it's like going to the gym, you know, if you only are lifting like a 1 pound weight, it's probably not going to do much for you in terms of gains. Yet also, if you are lifting 50 pounds, that's also probably maybe too much if you've never been before. So let's find for something in the sort of the sweet spot in that middle that's challenging, it's hard, and also you're going to develop your strength where you're going to be able to learn that ultimately you can tolerate this distress and your feared outcomes don't happen. So for someone who's scared of getting their hands dirty, that, you know, they can get dirty and they may not get sick, or they'll get sick and it's actually not that bad. And
doesn't
okay.
kill them.
Exactly. Right?
Or it kills them and they don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah. That, fortunately, I will say that has not happened yet with any of my clients who I've done exposures with. But why, you know, one of the big things why I wanted to come on is because the more I've done this work, the more I see actually as exposure as being something that I think is just really helpful for so much of what people experience. And it informs a lot of the work that I'm doing with people, even in DBT. So what I'll say just very briefly is sort of like a science thing is a lot of research is increasingly showing that people with DBT, you know, come in for like typical DBT who have BPD or really life-threatening behaviors, have a history of some kind of trauma, oftentimes can meet criteria for PTSD. And so there's been increasing efforts in the field of DBT to adapt the treatment to specifically be targeting trauma, because you know, what we're doing in DBT is we're just talking about day in and day out the stuff you're experiencing. You want to drink, you want to, you know, cut yourself, whatever it may be, but we're not talking about, you know, when you were abandoned or when you were hit or what have you, right? So there's sort of two major ones that have sort of spun off around that. Both of them, though, are exposure-based treatments in terms of how we treat trauma. There's DBT-PE made by a woman named Melanie Harned. She's amazing. There's another treatment called DBT-PTSD made by this German guy named Martin Bohus. He's also amazing. They're great. They're both great. And basically what you're doing is you're trying to balance teaching people how to cope, because, you know, we're essentially the sort of the theory that I have around it is that people are suicidal, are self-harming, are ruminating, are shutting down, are cutting themselves off from other people, what have you, because of some fear that they're having, right? Something that they're scared of. Right? I'm going to get rejected by people, or people are going to see this horrible thing that's actually happened to me, or, you know, everyone, I'm going to figure out finally these people don't actually like, they don't love me, or I'm going to get fired, or whatever it might be. Right. And, what we then engage in are we call them target behaviors, stuff that I've been mentioning before, of the maladaptive coping mechanisms, why we learn skills to basically just when we're feeling a certain way, how we can best cope with that. Yet that's super helpful. Yet the thing is, and research has also shown this, if you have that sort of history of, you know, traumatic, maybe having gone through traumatic experiences or traumatic stress, and again, I think a lot of stuff people deal with has to do with these difficult experiences they've lived through, you know, and we're not getting to that kind of stuff, then you're basically going to kind of still keep dealing with it. You're going to cope with those stressors, yet you're not necessarily going to learn to decrease that level of stress, we can say. And so what's a way to help decrease the level of stress is through exposure. I mean, you watch a scary movie once, pretty scary. You watch it 1,000 times, probably not so scary anymore. And this is where when I tell people about exposure therapy, people often raise their eyebrows at me because it's almost like I become the anti-therapist. You think of a therapist mm-hmm. as someone who's like, it's going to be okay. You know, you're all right. And instead I sit there and I tell people, it's not going to be okay. It's not going to be all right. You know, this terrible thing's going to happen or what have you. And the reason for that is because so much of what we fear is out of our control. You mentioned before that like your therapist will like, you know, why haven't they responded to you? We don't know the facts, right? Mm. And what you're probably afraid of is people are going to reject you, right? Mm. Which I don't like either. I don't think anybody likes it. How much of that really is in our control though, right? You know, we can be fully ourselves, and people are not going to like us for that sometimes. And that's okay. What can we do about that, right? And what happens is when we're trying to change ourselves in order to make other people happy, that doesn't feel good. Right? We're people pleasing. We feel inauthentic, what have you. Sometimes even people do this to such an extent that they feel empty on the inside. That doesn't really work out now, does it? And so what we can learn instead is to tolerate the fears that some people may not like us and that we can see we can live through it. And then what does that do is, well, that reduces a lot of the worries that we have, a lot of the stresses that we have. We then no longer feel the need to maybe engage in some of these behaviors like self-harming or feeling suicidal or drinking or lashing out at people or getting so upset. And then what happens is, well, life just feels a little bit better. We it's easier for us to feel kind of happy, to feel like ourselves, to know ourselves. And it's why it's so often, while when I work with people, I obviously want them to feel comfortable with me. I want to establish that. I want to make sure they know how to deal with stressors day in and day out, because if you just throw someone into a scary situation, they don't know how to cope, that's going to go really poorly. Okay. We don't want to do that. Ultimately though, what I do want them to learn is that they can tolerate all the shitty stuff that, you know, they feel like for one reason or another, they can't, whether it's disappointing somebody, whether it's saying the wrong thing on a podcast, maybe, for example, right? To be frank, I expose myself to my fears all my times. All the times. There you go. I'm constantly like, I'll make a mistake or I'll say something and I'll lean into it. I'll go, yeah, everybody thinks that was so stupid, whatever, all this sort of stuff. And initially it was pretty challenging and it could be painful and it could be sad and I could feel really stuck in it sometimes. And the more I do it, the more I'm just like, I kind of just shrug it off and I'm like, whatever, you know, because so often I know, you know, you and I've shared our fears that people are going to listen and think this is stupid. And so often, you know, you were saying you listen to me and you feel like that I know what I'm talking about as the same I listen to you. And I feel like,
oh my God,
I know what you're talking about, right? Very rarely is it the case that these things that we're so scared of are necessarily definitively going to happen. They can though. And more often than too, also if someone's going to listen to this podcast and they're going to hear me say something maybe wrong or maybe sound kind of dumb, and then they're going to really judge me for that. Well, you know, that's a bummer. I wish it didn't happen. And also, what can I do about that?
Right.
You know, that it is what it is kind of thing. Like, that stinks. And I'd rather instead just like learn that that can happen and I'll be okay. And instead I can focus my attention on trying to still, you know, present information that I think is really helpful that I want people to know about, because I just want people to be able to have tools to make their lives better. That's
what does exposure therapy look like for the ruminating thoughts that, I'm a fuck up and
yeah,
people aren't going to love me.
Yeah. I mean, it's, we want to get down to what's the fear, right? What is it that we're afraid of? You know, if it's something like people are going to reject me, people don't love me, I'm fucking up. Well, then we can do, there are sort of, I'll say there are three categories of exposures that we can do. There's in vivo, which means in real life. So that's where we go out and we do stuff that where we are fucking up, for example.
Intentionally making mistakes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you make mistakes. You send emails with typos. I've had people before like go to, you know, Trader Joe's just after working out and they smell and they're stinky and you can stand close to people. I mean, I apologize to any folks who have been to Trader Joe's and been around some smelly, you know, gym goers. And at the same time, it's a way of like being like, oh, my God, everyone's going to judge me and reject me for it. Right. There's also imaginal exposures in which we write a script of something that is, you know, sort of in our imagination. With trauma work, a lot of times we use imaginal exposures, but for traumatic memories. So this sort of one memory that kind of plays over and over again in our head. We write a script out and we record it and we listen to it over and over and over again. Or we can do it also with feared scenarios. So let's say I'm scared that, you know, everyone's going to reject me and hate me and I'm going to end up, you know, I don't know, like without any friends, shuttering myself inside, et cetera, you know, die friendless and penniless. We can write out that script and then record it and listen to it over and over again. So those are in vivo and imaginal. And then the last category of exposures, this one's actually more helpful with people who have more sort of like panic disorder. So they get they get panic attacks. They're called interoceptive exposures. And basically that's an exposure for physical symptoms in and of themselves, which often comes up too for people. It's actually, I think, something related to rumination. So, I mean, let's say growing up, you know, I mentioned my parents can argue. Let's say growing up, every time my parents argued, my stomach would turn because it's scary. And then what do I start to see is that when my stomach turns, no matter the reason, that's actually something that I start to associate as something scary in and of itself. Anytime my stomach turns, I start to think, oh my God, what's wrong? Oh, something's happening. I may not even connect the dots. It has to do with my parents fighting. Yet all I know is, oh, I'm starting to panic and so on and so forth, right? Panic attacks, fortunately, are not actually dangerous to experience. They're not going to cause any real harm to you. They're just incredibly unpleasant and scary. You can feel like you're dying. Fortunately, it's not going to happen. And so with interoceptive exposures, it's going to sound mean, yet it's true. We basically are having people do stuff to cause their physical symptoms. So people sometimes have what's called emetophobia, which is the term for fear of vomit. And that can include also fears of like gagging or like their stomach, you know, feeling like full and nauseous. So you can have people like drink a milkshake and then run up and down the stairs. So, you know, or people who are scared of getting dizzy, like dizziness is something they associate with being something wrong. So you have them spin around in a chair a million times over and over. A lot of times when people have panic when driving or flying, it's related to this kind of stuff. And again, it's the thing I try to tell people is, you know, it is deeply unpleasant work. Exposure is not fun to be doing. And it's something that we sacrifice in the short term for the long term, because when we no longer fear these physical sensations, we're not experiencing this panic and distress, when we're no longer scared about everyone rejecting us, well, then it's easier for us to go out into the world and crack the joke we want to make, or reach out to the friend we want to reach out to, you know, send that message we've been thinking about. It just, those things become so much easier for us to do, and we ruminate then less around them. I wanted to say before also, rumination, one of the reasons we do it is to actually try to not feel physical sensations in our body. So a DBT skill we have for that is called mindfulness of emotion. So if anyone's ruminating out there, just try to focus on what you're feeling in your body. It actually, what happens is as you focus on that, those sensations kind of pass. You're no longer so upset. You're not ruminating quite as much anymore.
I think everybody who's listening is wondering what flavor milkshake.
Oh,
you can't just throw milkshake out there without a flavor.
I mean, the way that I would approach that with clients, because I don't know, maybe this is my own, I need to work on my own exposure a bit more. With interoceptives, a lot of times I feel so bad when I do it to clients, because I feel like a bully almost. But I would say probably whatever is the one that most is a little nauseating inducing. Oh, right? Wow. You really don't like strawberry? Then let's do a strawberry
Earl
milkshake.
Earl Grey would be mine.
Or I guess also what's accessible. I mean, listen, if Earl Grey ice cream is a little hard to get in your area, that's fine.
I don't even know if it exists. I just hate Earl Grey tea.
Oh, I'm sure there's, I mean, in the States.
It feels like somebody over perfumed fell into your tea.
Yeah, no, you don't, especially with ice cream too. That's a good point. Like, I don't want perfumey kind of taste in my mouth. Right. No.
Yeah. Like blue cheese ice cream.
Oh,
cast you to hell.
Yeah.
Whoever came up with that.
Yeah, no, that's deeply, deeply unpleasant stuff. Yeah.
Well, Ethan, I so appreciate you coming by. I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about, but I think what I'd like to do is have you back on in the future to talk about some other stuff that you do. But this has been the best deep dive into DBT that we've ever done.
Oh,
on the podcast.
That's very kind of you. I would be honored to come on anytime you want me.
Yeah, here's where you fucked up. Yeah. And this is going to be a good 15 minutes.
Yeah.
where can people find you? You do therapy both in Los Angeles, and you're licensed in New York as well.
That's correct. And also New Jersey and Massachusetts. It's like post-COVID, it's kind of become a thing where a lot of folks are getting licensed in other states. Just people move, whatever. But I'm a part of a group practice called Behavioral Psych Studio. I'm the clinical director of our LA office. And a lot of what we do is DBT, yet all the things that I talked about is what we do, exposure and a lot of other things. But I mean, you can look me up. You'll find my Psychology Today. I hope you don't find any of my old film criticism, but I'm sure that's out there.
Exposure therapy. You should read some of your old articles to me. While I mock you.
You know, the thing is, I can feel the distress right now. That would be really effective for me. I'm going to be honest. That would actually be a really good exposure.
You know what? The next time we have you on, print them out.
Oh my God.
And bring them.
Why am I starting to sweat now?
And maybe I'll bring some of the worst reviews on Apple podcasts that I've gotten.
I think this is, I love this. The spirit of exposure. I'm all about it. Lean into your fears. I love it. This is great.
What was I going to say? And are you personally taking on clients, or you're just the director?
No, I do see clients. I'm a little kind of on the fuller side right now. So it just might be a little tough if anyone wants to like reach out to me right now. But the thing that I'll say, like, again, I really feel very indebted to the people I've learned from. That's why I was trying to name some names, and so people can feel like they have stuff they can look into and Google. I also just really care about people finding good support and good therapy and getting what they're looking for and getting the stuff that they feel like they need. So if anybody does reach out to me and I, for whatever reason, I'm not able to take on new clients, I'm more than happy to try and pass along other names to people, or even if they feel like I'm not the right fit for them and they still want resources to other people who they could see, I'm so happy to do that too. I'm all about people finding good care. So, yeah, I do see clients. Mm-hmm. That's why I got into this, and I like doing it a lot. And, you know, if you're, for whatever reason, you're not able to see me, I'm more than happy to still try to help if I can.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was one of the more enlightening episodes I've ever had. I learned so much in that conversation. I hope you did too. We're going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors. Let's get into some surveys. And as always, I mention this every week, apologize. No, don't apologize. We could use help on Patreon. Patreon.com/mentalpod. It keeps the podcast going, and we really need your support. At the $5 a month level, you get the bonus surveys. Every week, we do about 20 minutes of bonus surveys. There are lots of other tiers. Probably the next most popular one is the $20 a month one, and that qualifies you to do our online Zoom meeting once a week. There are Saturday mornings for people in Europe, and then there's another one on Sunday afternoons for people on US. I mean, you could go to either one, no matter where you live, but those are the times. All right. Speaking of surveys, this is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Payne and Colada. I think we read one of her surveys last week. And she writes, do you have any advice for the situation I'm in? I'm stuck in my head and therefore in my life. I'm in desperate need for some new impulses, as the town I live in is very small and I'm alone a lot. But my loneliness, and what I suspect is actually some depression-like moods, makes me so negative towards change. I used to be quick and easy. I would move and do something if I felt something wasn't right. Now I'm the opposite. One thing that keeps me here is I have a psychologist that works pretty well here. But aside from that, I want to live somewhere with more life. My neighborhood consists of retired people or families. I'm a single lady in my 30s. By the way, I live in Sweden, so people here are not as outgoing as I guess they are in the States. My psychologist says I have to get a job first and foremost, and that will solve a lot, but I feel I must get the heck out of this place first. Any thoughts? I feel like I'm spiraling slowly, wasting another year in loneliness and sitting on the fence of what could have been a more flourishing life. Well, you know, first of all, thank you for that. And I think so many of us relate to that. And for many of us, myself included, the fear of change has to be outweighed often by the willingness to actually change something. And what makes it so hard is that you're feeling depressed. And boy, decision-making is one of the things that gets destroyed by depression, or at least negatively affected it. It's so hard to make decisions when we're depressed. Not only the energy to do it, but just the clarity to do it, because we're so clouded with often anxiety and doom around making that decision, or feeling overwhelmed of where do I even begin. So I don't know, other than to say stick with your psychologist or a psychologist. Hopefully the one you're with would be able to do online sessions if you do move. But baby steps somewhere would be my suggestion. I don't know where that would begin, but I know one thing is staying stuck in the head that is feeling sick is just really hard to use the brain that got us in the place we're in the first place. I don't know if that makes sense. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Empty Nest Jenna. And about her workaholism, she writes, when you're happy to do every one of the Thanksgiving dishes, despite your bad back, an allergy to dish soap, terrible water pressure in the sink, and a smoke alarm going off repeatedly in the kitchen, because it still beats having to smile and chat with the pack of vipers in the dining room. Oh my God, that's so good. Another one about workaholism. Shaving years off your life by grinding through the chronic health problems daily to grow the 401k you'll never live to use. Wow. Only using vacations and sick days to catch up on emails and overdue projects while covering for colleagues you insist need some proper time off. I think there's also codependency going on in there. Snapshot from her life, another one about workaholism. It's somewhat illegible as a proper addiction. I'm not sure she might have meant ineligible. And also, oh, fucking word correction. The number of times I've sent a text where it changes a word or somebody's name to something else. Anyways, because what people mostly see is how effective slash productive slash successful you are. You fall apart, ulcer by ulcer, arthritic joint by arthritic joint, abandoned bucket list items by abandoned bucket list item, just so you can take your 800th unsuccessful whack at having a week where you complete more tasks than you add. There is no pleasure or excitement, no momentary high, only the mixed relief of knowing you'll probably never be fired because, of course, that's the only thing in the world that would bring this self-made death march to an end, which you'll never allow to happen. Wow. Those are so good. And I cannot relate at all to workaholism. I can relate to other addictions, and I'm ashamed to say that sometimes I look with envy at people with workaholism, kind of like what you mentioned, because we see the success, the productivity, but we never know what it's like. I've never known what it's like to have the insides of a person with workaholism. Thank you for that. This is an email that I got. It's from a news outlet that I don't recognize, but I thought it was interesting, and so I clicked on it because it said older men are using this for their manhood, and I found some really helpful things. I've learned how to practice adding www to website addresses. I've gone back to using the phone book. And it's so comforting opening the yellow pages. And I've also gone back to using an AOL address. And if you need to get a hold of me, email me, baby. I'm a hot stick of dynamite at AOL.com. And if you've never been to AOL, it's www.aol.com. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Zipper Horse. She identifies as bisexual. She's in her 30s, says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and reported it. I'm going to skip the graphic details of this, but I'll give you the broad strokes. The first instance of sexual abuse that I remember occurred when I was about 2 years old. Unfortunately, I can't remember the face of the person who did this to me. A couple of years later, I remember abuse taking the form of playing doctor with one sibling. And if you are listening, I did not skip the details because I don't think that you should have written them there. No, I'm grateful when people share their stories and include details, because that can often be the hardest part of us going back into those icky memories. Our brain wants to keep it vague and not feel the full weight of it. So I appreciate you doing that, but sometimes I feel like the surveys that I read is kind of Just too much of the graphic stuff. She's been physically abused and emotionally abused. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yes, I have many positive experiences with them. My situation feels easier to move forward with than others I've heard on the podcast. In my case, children were abusing children, so even my abusers were really not at fault for what happened. Darkest thoughts. Sometimes I wish I didn't have kids so I could just kill myself. I took suicide off the table when I had kids. Darkest secrets. I don't remember learning about sex, but I remember asking my sibling to have sex with me when I was about 6. I didn't know how people got pregnant, but I knew the mechanics of sex. This is scary to me because I know that the only reason I would have had the knowledge and interest to ask for sex at that age leads me to believe that it wasn't the first time I'd had penetrative sex. By the time I was 10, I had started repeating the abusive behavior on my younger siblings. Paul, it was a whole mess. 5 of my siblings were being abused and abusing others, and the abuse spread to other families in our neighborhood. When I was 12, my mother confronted me to ask what was going on, and after some resistance, I told her. I told her my brother and stepsister abused me, that I'd abused my siblings, and it had been going on for as long as I could remember. I feel unfairly frustrated with myself for not being able to remember the first person who abused me. I feel sad because, in a way, I feel I was ruined when I was that young, and I'm angry that I never had a chance to be a normal, happy kid. My mom got all of us kids into therapy for the next 2 years, which was helpful, especially for my younger siblings. My mom said that she asked my therapist if I needed victim therapy, and they told her that I didn't. I was viewed as a predator, actively seeking to do harm due to selfishness and a lack of care for others. While I found my individual therapy to be mildly helpful, my group therapy was for kids, quote, like me, unquote, who abused other kids. We worked through a binder of assignments that we essentially checked off in group. One assignment was to be open and upfront about what we had done. No details were allowed to be spared. With 2 therapists and about 10 other kids in the room, we would walk the room through every instance of abuse that we had committed. For me, this wasn't possible as it had been going on for so long. Saying that I didn't know how many times abuse had occurred led to the therapist thinking I was lying and avoiding taking accountability. So the therapist would lead the assignment, and we were instructed to walk the group step by step through the situation, what room we were in, what was said. But the hardest part was talking about how we did what we did. If we said we touched our victim's arm, which hand did we touch them with? How did you abuse them? As in, what motions were you doing? And for how long? The therapist would then pause the group, set a timer, and he would perform the action we were describing with his hand on the table to demonstrate exactly what we did for how long. That sounds really fucked up to me. I'm not a therapist, but I would be interested to know what other therapists think of what you were doing, because my initial impression hearing this, and again, I'm not a mental health professional, but it sounds like the therapist or therapists were getting something out of this. Another assignment was becoming our victim. They would set up 2 chairs, 1 for us and 1 for our victim. And we'd go through everything again, minus the hand demonstrations. We would sit in the victim chair and answer for them about how they felt when X happened or what they were thinking during Y. By the end of therapy, I was self-harming and actively wanting to kill myself. In high school, my mom saw my arms and took me to another therapist. I told him everything. I told him that I was a horrible person, so horrible that if I went to jail, I'd be killed by the other inmates for being an abuser. He told my mom I was cutting for attention, and that was the end of therapy. The self-harming and suicidality continued relentlessly. Now I understand why sexually abused children sometimes repeat the abuse on other kids. Now I understand that reenacting abuse as a child is a way of trying to process what has happened to you and not that an 8-year-old is a predator. I wish I'd had someone to tell me that when I was in therapy for the first time. Wow. Wow. That those sessions, it's jaw-dropping to me. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I have fantasies about rape, being humiliated, and being dominated. I feel uncomfortable and ashamed, particularly of the rape fantasies. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Mom, when you told me that one time that your brother touched you, but you didn't go on to abuse anyone, that really fucked me up. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace, feelings of hope, to be loved. Have you shared these things with others? When I was in high school, my mom noticed lots of cuts and scratches on my arms and took me to see a therapist. When he asked me why I did it, I laid it all out. I told him that I know that child molesters are the worst of the worst and that other inmates kill them, and I was even worse because I was an abuser when I was so little, so it just proved I was completely bad. The therapist told my mom, I was cutting for attention. That was the only time I saw the therapist, thank God, but my mom never mentioned the cutting again. And I was not rereading what she had written in a previous one. That was just some of the stuff was repeated in the answer to that question. How do you feel after writing these things down? Kind of sad remembering everything, but a little better too. I don't want pity or awe, you poor thing. I just want someone to hear my story. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experience? If you were abused as a child, I'm so sorry that happened to you. You did nothing to deserve it, and it does not define you. Amen. Amen. Sending you some love. And I'm glad that you got to hear your story read, and that we got to hear your story. And it may seem like I am specifically choosing shame and secrets surveys that involve these topics, incest, childhood sexual abuse, but I'm not. I'm going in order on many of these. I usually read the ones, the Shame and Secrets survey, that don't have that in it, because it's, but this is a section of society, and I feel that it is, I don't know why I'm justifying the podcast that I'm in charge of. I guess I want you to know, if you're thinking to yourself, Jesus Christ, Paul, give it a fucking break. No, this is representative, at least for the people who listen and take the surveys. This is representative of them. Doing a lot of apologizing this episode, and I apologize for that. Sweet Mother of God. And then this is a survey that I wanted to read because It to me is the opposite end of the spectrum from the therapy that our previous survey filler went through. And this is from the first day in therapy survey. And this is filled out by a woman in her between 26 and 35. And what brought you to therapy? I had anxiety attacks and gastritis. I was struggling a lot with my work because I made a huge mistake. I couldn't stand my boss anymore. My family was getting really chaotic, and my sister was having health issues. Describe any fears you had associated with starting therapy. That I would get manipulated. That whatever I say would be used as a weapon against me. That my therapist wasn't the right fit, and I couldn't trust her. that she would use, quote, alternative, unquote, remedies without scientific support, that she would judge me, that I wouldn't ever get better, that I could hurt her. Did any of your fears come true? Not even one of them. What worked best for you in therapy? Being able to be myself in that space without the need to hide behind a mask. Being able to share some of my biggest fears, traumas, and getting validation, something I hadn't been able to do with anybody else. Being vulnerable, writing things down on how I feel. What were your initial impressions of your therapist? I wanted to see her credentials at first, so that we could define right away how this was going to work, which didn't happen. Do you feel you can be completely honest with your therapist? I'm getting there, but usually when I want to hide my emotions or thoughts, I have to remind myself that it is okay to show the real me. Anything you'd like to share with a new group of therapists? In my neurotic mind, I would have preferred a different therapist with more structure, and that would give me a detailed information up front, but then I wouldn't have found my current therapist who is really compassionate and I have a really profound relationship with. Remember that it doesn't matter that much the psychology stream you are in. What really heals is the relationship with your client. It's beautiful. So beautiful. Thank you for that. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Big Mama. And she writes, I've always had weight issues, which is hard when you have an eating disorder and no one can see it since you're still chubby. I confided in a friend in eighth grade. I think I was struggling with being bulimic, and she cracked up and said, you? Good one. Like I was making a joke, which was an awfulsome moment in the first place. And I've been trying to be nice and kind to myself since having kids. I don't want them to grow up to have issues like me. Well, fast forward to a recent doctor visit I had and had my little ones in tow. And of course, a very attractive medical assistant was checking me and had to get my weight. As I'm frantically shedding my purse, coat, shoes, wondering how much my socks weigh, and God, why didn't I wear leggings instead of jeans, because the jeans are at least 20 pounds, right? I hop on the scale, and my four-year-old cheers, wow, Mom, you weigh like 1,000 pounds. You're so big. Like it was the proudest moment of their lives. And both of my kids start cheering for me down the hallway. Go, Big Mama. Go, Big Mama. Nothing humbles you more than having kids. Oh, my God. That is a Hall of Fame awfulsome moment. Thank you for that. Love it. Love it. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, never, ever, ever. And this is a command. This is not a suggestion. Never forget that you're not alone. You can look around and you think everybody's got it together and nobody's worried, and we're all fighting some type of war inside of us. Our external circumstances might be different, but yeah, I don't think there is a life without a fight. Or battle. At least I don't know anybody. If you find one, send them to me and I'll interview them. Anyway, you're not alone, and thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.